ER101. In conjunction with the American College of Emergency Physicians, get the 411 on your 911. Here's your host, Dr. Lee Vinoker.
Hi, and welcome back to ER 101. We are talking about Ebola with our two experts, Dr. Arati Vukmir, who has written extensively about it and in infectious disease in general, and Dr. David Piggott, who has authored multiple articles and chapters on viral hemorrhagic fevers and is a reviewer on those for The Lancet. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the symptoms. You know, we said high fever, Dr. Piggott, which is associated with those aches. It's always when your fever goes up, you have those bone and terrible aches. But the danger in this, and we're going to talk about what the risk is to the general public and to contacts, is in the symptomatology from that. I mean, it's called a hemorrhagic fever, right? Because it causes bleeding.
So the typical onset, it's always described in the literature as abrupt. So rapid onset, fever, chills, body aches, fatigue, just not feeling well. And as previously mentioned, that typically occurs between 8 and 10 days after exposure, although most of the cases that we've seen in the United States, they don't know exactly when they were exposed. They may have known approximately, but not, you know, a definitive time, because in those cases, they didn't even know they were exposed. So those initial nonspecific symptoms are maybe confused with other viral illnesses, or if in patients in Africa, things like typhoid fever or malaria. Following those, chest pain, shortness of breath, headache, red eyes, that is the whites of the eyes might start to turn red. Those are some of the symptoms that may occur a few days later.
Is that because you get those bleeds in, like, subconjunctival hemorrhage, which is the medical term? You know, people can get them for no reason without being sick, where a little blood vessel bursts in the white part of your eye. Is that why it does that?
Yeah, that's basically the underlying reason, just because what Ebola does is it creates kind of a leaky capillary or a leaky blood vessel effect that can cause initially some of that redness on your eyes, then later bleeding under your skin, which could look like bruising, like deep bruising or a dark rash, as well as even in later stages, frank bleeding from the gums, from the nose, from the GI tract.
Wow.
And just as an example from the critical care experience, you know, this would be a classic DIC presentation, and that's some of the progression that's been seen. The earlier version of the virus, again, with a 90% mortality, you know, the presentation of people was this massive bleeding component, and combining the high sort of viral lethality with this clinical appearance, you know, the disease died off quickly as patients were ultimately avoided in some cases. But now, you know, it's sort of, again, bridled back its virulence a bit, and there's a greater chance of transmission.
Right. And what's interesting, when you see DIC, it just means you're bleeding all internally, you're going into shock, and, you know, and that's the problem. And, you know, what's interesting, and that's why talking about the risk to the general public too, Dr. Piggott, but what was interesting to me is, you know, this hysteria, and I'm old enough and probably older than both of you. I remember the hysteria when I was in med school or just starting med school with HIV until they figured out what it was, and then we sort of realized it's a blood precaution and that you have to use these universal precautions. But HIV is a virus that is just not shedding massive amounts of the viral load. And I think, you know, we were seeing healthcare providers, even in Africa, isn't it true that it's the healthcare providers or the people who lived in the houses with them or were burying them because they're just bleeding so much. It's such profuse vomiting, diarrhea with blood in it, that the virus is just being kind of spewed out by these people. Right, doctor?
That's correct. They're basically, in the late stages of the disease, shedding large amounts of virus, both in vomiting and diarrhea. And the studies that have been done of patients that are dying of the disease or have died of the disease have found large amounts of virus in the very skin of the patients. So simple contact with the skin of a patient in the end stages of the disease without personal protective equipment could cause potential infection.
And is that, you think, because, I mean, it's the same way, you know, when people get cellulitis, they don't always know what little teeny microscopic break in the skin they have that a bacteria got in. And it's the same thing. You're not, you know, even though our skin's a good barrier.
Correct.
You know,
there
you don't.
Potentially could be tiny breaks in the skin that could cause a patient to be infected by contact, even skin contact with a patient who has advanced disease. I think an important point here is it's really advanced disease where these patients are markedly contagious. What we've seen is on the patients that are flying on the airplanes with patients with Ebola, patients who are not yet symptomatic, none of those people are getting infected because the patient is not markedly infectious at that point. Even sitting next to somebody on an airplane or on the subway with the early stages of Ebola, you're not going to get infected.
And Dr. Vukmer, it's so the people that had the, you know, so the people that were the most at risk, and I think the problem with the nurses, too, is initially they must have had some skin or there was an area while they were still testing the patient, and if he wasn't that forthright and he was having a lot of diarrhea, any kind of splash, that's how the nurses got infected. Because it was amazing to me in the Texas case that his fiancée did not get infected and never tested positive.
Right. You know, and you bring up an important point, you know, and when we consider sort of viral transmission, what we recognize is that the blood viremia, you know, is the big offender. It's got the highest concentration of virus particles. You know, we then sort of, again, work backwards. We think that GI, you know, tract secretions, either vomiting or diarrhea, is probably next most. And then lastly, things like sweat. So, again, we need to sort of be intelligent in how we sort of deal with patients. You point out a valid fact that it was the healthcare providers that were involved. Very quickly, recognize that, you know, in the health community, we tend to stick with a universal precautions model. So we trained around a low viral load condition like HIV and hepatitis and work with that in the trauma environment typically. But again, it's sort of a gown glove type situation. You know, when we look at Ebola, this was something that very quickly was recognized that we needed to transition to more of a hazmat type protective and recognize that any skin exposure was a concern. So what we're left with is a situation where we almost have two models and we're transitioning from more of a hospital-based EMS model in regards to PPE and protectives.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. But by the same token, you know, the doctor in New York, I mean, he probably did, even though he was following protocol, he knew he had a big risk, and maybe we should be a little more sensitive to the public's feelings and fright about it and do a little self-quarantine. Anyway, this is ER 101. I'm Dr. Lee Van Oker on Radio MD. Stay well and tune in to your health.